Mary Lou, thanks very much. And I think we're delighted that she's going to be able to stay most of the day. So this is a super advantage for us. We are actually a little bit ahead of schedule, so I'm going to just take 1 minute to ask if anyone has a question that you want to bring up right now, just to clarify how we're going to proceed, because if not, then I think we'll go ahead and start with our first speaker. But I just wanted to give this brief moment. So any thoughts in the room? Okay. All right. Very good. All right. The one thing I forgot to mention that I did want to mention, what the task force is doing has been very nicely spelled out in our statement of task. And this is available also on the TAMS.org website. So I failed to mention that, but I want to make everyone aware who's not specifically part of the task force exactly what it is we're trying to do, and a very good way to know that is to have a look at the task force document. It's not very long, don't worry. our report may be more than 100 pages long, but the statement of task is short, pretty short and sweet. All right, well, with that, our first speaker is Peter Hennings. So, Peter, if you are ready, we'll let you get started.
Thank you.
It's an honor to be here today, and I'm flattered to be trusted by Brian and Chris and Craig to talk a bit about geology and seismicity. I'm a research scientist at the Bureau of Economic Geology, and I am a principal investigator in our new Center for Integrated Seismicity Research. And I'll talk a little bit about that a little bit later in the presentation. All right. This graph, produced by Alexandro Cervedes, he leads our TextNet monitoring network, shows really why I'm here today to talk about seismicity in Texas. And as this graph shows, there has been a dramatic increase in the rate of seismicity in Texas following the rest of this southern mid-continent of the United States since about 2008. And that increase in seismicity has happened in a number of very key places, such as the Dallas-Fort Worth metropolitan area, and the Fort Worth Basin, also areas of West Texas, South Texas, and East Texas. And I'll touch briefly on some of those areas now. SMU, in cooperation with the USGS, has been monitoring the seismicity in the Fort Worth Basin over the last several years, and has developed a catalog with the USGS showing these three areas or occurrences or swarms of seismicity in Azle, Texas, in the Irving area, and then in Venus. And the USGS, over the last several years, has reported 204 magnitude 1.8 earthquakes since 2008, and then with their much more able network, SMU has recorded 1,500 small earthquakes ranging from magnitude 0 to 4 since their network has been operative in 2003. And I'll zoom in just briefly for some of those areas. In the Azle area, beginning in 2013, SMU's network has imaged a swarm of seismicity that, from a geologist's perspective, as well as theirs, resolves itself into a system of faults with a main fault that is well down in the deep crystalline basement and also branching faults in the overlying sediments. And taking an early slice through this data, Hornback and others at SMU proposed this relatively simple model that suggests a linkage between injection in the aquifer nearby and that seismicity. Other slices through SMU's catalog, shown here in the Venus area, southwest of Dallas-Fort Worth, shows a fairly complicated pattern of seismicity with several different locations that do resolve themselves into faults, such as this dipping swarm here, again in the deep crystalline basement underneath the Venus area. And then finally, Irving, which is really an amazing pattern of seismicity from 2014 and ongoing today, resolving itself into a fault-like structure, again in cross-section view, shows a nice dipping plane, again down in the deep crystalline basement. Not all the seismicity is at that depth, but the majority of it certainly is. Some new results from the Institute for Geophysics here at UT shows characterizations of seismicity elsewhere in the state, and this seismicity was derived from the existing seismic network, also the transportable array, which was operated by the EarthScope program. In far west Texas, the greater Permian Basin area, Jake Walter and his colleagues find seismicity that is presumably natural in its origin and also seismicity that is in temporal and spatial proximity to oil and gas operations. And Jake and his colleagues will be more completely characterizing that in the coming months. Also, in the panhandle of Texas, a very surprisingly wealthy catalog of seismicity spanning back to 2008 along a very important tectonic and structural trend. And then in East Texas and also Louisiana, some patterns of seismicity which are very concentrated in their epicentral locations, and some authors have related those to injection operations nearby. So detailed cataloging of seismicity is already underway in Texas, and that will, of course, be greatly augmented when the TexNet network comes online later this year. So shale basins and injection. As you know, Texas is so wealthy with regard to the potential for shale development with the Fort Worth Basin, the Haynesville and Bossier, the Eagleford Trend, and then the greater Permian Basin out west, and also superimposed on this map in black is the recent seismicity, and in purple represents the injection wells and that very complicated operational history portrayed by that pattern of injection. Since record keeping began in the 1930s, there have been over 50,000 injection wells permitted in the state. There are something like 34,000 active injection wells operating today, and most of those are associated with oil and gas operations. And there are roughly 8,000 Class II UIC wells, which are permitted for injection. And many of those wells are injecting at relatively deep levels. So just a comment about Texas geology. The folks that invited me to speak today wanted me to show some maps regarding Texas and its geologic complexity. Texas has perhaps 12 different tectonic geologic provinces in a very interesting geologic mosaic, and a blow-up of the West Texas Greater Permian Basin area shows the Midland Basin and the Delaware sub-basins in a mosaic of, I would say, very interesting and complicated geology with many important deeply rooted faults and many related faults in a complicated geologic history. All right. So just want to talk briefly about mechanisms for induced seismicity, which would be the roadmap for the next few slides that I'll discuss. So Anna Kuchman, in an article she published in Scientific American earlier this year, really nicely portrayed what most researchers in this field believe is happening, That is that pre-existing faults, often at very deep levels, when subjected to a change in their pore fluid environment, become reactivated because those pore fluid pressures tend to counteract the stresses that keep those faults locked in geologic time scales. And this is her nice diagram representing that. So the key factors from the geologic perspective that have to be considered in understanding induced seismicity are shown here. Of course, we have to have fault systems. We can't have seismicity without movement on faults. The in situ stress environment in the subsurface is critical. Then, of course, the capacity and the continuity of the disposal intervals is a key parameter, as is the perturbation of the pressures that might come within those disposal zones. A very interesting thing, but also a very challenging aspect, is all of those four factors are dynamically linked. And if you change one of them, you change all of the rest in a very physically complex and coupled way. But when these factors combine in the right magnitudes, spatially and temporally, faults can be reactivated, producing seismicity. So I'll just talk briefly about these four factors. Faults. What we observed in the recent seismicity throughout the southern mid-continent of Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas is almost all of the seismicity that's being observed is occurring on previously unrecognized faults that don't occur in the literature and are not documented. This presents a large challenge with regard to hazard identification and subsurface characterization. This is a map from Oklahoma with seismicity in black and known faults in the colored lines, and then from the Fort Worth Basin, the areas of seismicity in Irving and Venus and Azle shown there, and the known faults as the black lines. So faults. Faults are definitely not simple planes, as I think a lot of people envision. They're complicated. Here's a fault from Arches National Park in Moab, Utah, where there are many small faults associated with a much bigger fault that isn't really even displayed in the photograph. And a little computational model that I'll show you in the next slide, I think nicely shows how faults grow and how they become complicated. So in this slide, what you'll see is a computer model, but I think it's a nice representation of how a fault grows out of deep levels, maybe the deep crystalline rocks, and into the sediments above. And as the model runs forward, what you'll see is the fault is propagating upwards through alternations of strong and weak rock, such as layered rock sequences typically are. And as it grows, it forms a very complicated mosaic of individual segments, splays, and branches, and so on, forming a very typical-looking fault zone. That's how faults would grow geologically, and it's my guess as a geologist that seismicity, when it occurs on fault systems, also occurs in this kind of a complicated branching and stepping way, not just along simple planes. Mark Zoback and his colleague Gorelick at Stanford provide this. I think it's a complicated diagram, but it nicely synthesizes how earthquake magnitude and fault size, the area of the fault, and rupture length are related. And so for an earthquake of magnitude 3 or 4, the kinds of magnitudes we're most interested in for triggered seismicity, those magnitudes occur on faults that would be the size of maybe an aerial expanse of a football field, or up to a kilometer or so, that might slip a centimeter. You know, that's a very small feature in terms of the subsurface and our ability to characterize that using typical subsurface analysis techniques. And this little diagram here shows a small patch that might have slipped within a larger existing fault surface. All right, that's faults. Next topic is stress. Building an understanding of the stress state in the subsurface is a very challenging pursuit. and something that I've been involved in for many years with my history in the industry. Wellbore data from drilling is typically used to develop these types of curves representing subsurface depth, and when properly integrated, you can derive an estimation of the stress state in the subsurface, but it takes the integration of a lot of expensive data to come up with these types of interpretations. Interpretations of what the orientations of the stresses are and what the ratios or their magnitudes are. Once you have that information, though, you can apply it, such as this very simple and iconic diagram, as to how the stress state existing before injection in this black circle might shift to the left, becoming the blue circle, touching that red failure line, which then represents the potential for reactivation on an existing fault. This is sort of the simplest mechanical description of how this stress information might cause fault slip and seismicity. This is an exciting new product from Mark Zoback's research group at Stanford, from Jens Snee. It shows a new stress map for Texas. The black tick lines represents the orientation of maximum stress in the horizontal view. The colors represent the different types of stress style. The yellows are strike slip, and the blues represent normal faulting stress style. And there is a very interesting pattern of heterogeneity in the orientations of the stress and also the type of faulting that might occur from northeast Texas to the Gulf Coast and out to a very complicated mosaic of patterns in west Texas, something we're going to have to deal with in terms of risking and prediction as our models advance. All right. Fluid pressure. This is a chart of fluid pressure, fluid injection history in the Fort Worth Basin. And what it shows is injection in blue in the very deep Ellenberger intervals, and then this gray represents all of the other intervals of injection. So for instance, just looking at the blue, there's roughly on the order of 10 million barrels of fluid injected into the Ellenberger intervals per month. And the average Ellenberger injection well is shown by this amber curve at 40,000 barrels per well per month, compared to typical injection wells in the basin of 10,000, those typical wells being related to oil and gas development, compared to the amber wells related to disposal. This slide from Tim Tyrell shows a very simple set of analytical equations that can be used to predict the pore pressure and the distribution of pore pressure in the subsurface for wells undergoing injection, injection of water here, and how that pore pressure impact spreads out through time. And also from Tim and his colleagues are these idealized models with a couple of injection wells here and here which have started to inject and perturb their pore pressure regimes, and how over time those halos of disturbance are spreading out and starting to merge with an area of elevated fluid pressure, and then how those areas of elevated fluid pressure are starting to perturb randomly oriented faults in the subsurface. And some of these faults are changing their color to red because they are sensitive to that pore fluid pressure change due to their characteristics. And these models are key in helping us understand how fluid pressure might contact faults and change their behavior, but they're also very simple, really very simple. And this is some seismic data from the Fort Worth Basin, which shows these surfaces looking down on top of the Ellenberger disposal interview at the deep floor of the Fort Worth Basin. And it shows all those pock marks represent karst and karst collapse features. And these lines represent faults. Karst and faults and other things in geologic formations provide very strong influences on fluid flow behavior, provide heterogeneity and anisotropy and how those fluid pressures move around. And so the message in this slide is these disposal intervals are geologically complicated. And we have to devise ways of dealing with that complication as we do mechanistic modeling to understand fluid pressures and seismicity. Pore pressure perturbations may spread surprisingly far and fast. This is a rather famous diagram from Say and Bruderhof that shows from the Rocky Mountain Arsenal how injection in one area spreads out to seismicity very quickly over 10 to 15 kilometers in a matter of months from the Rocky Mountain Arsenal. And then a recent paper from SMU, Hornbach and his colleagues, describing how fluid injection in these counties may be spreading out laterally in a surprisingly broad distribution of pore fluid pressures. But again, that's the simplest type of model describing what is a very complicated system. So one of the things that embodies what we do in our research program and where the science is headed is moving from associative types of analyses, such as you see on the left here, where Froelich and his colleagues have looked at the seismicity record in Texas and divided it into categories between being not associated with seismicity and injection to injection associated with seismicity. We need to move into a more mechanistic space where integrations of subsurface data can be done in a complete way to address the physical behavior. And this is a diagram from some work in progress here at the Bureau of Economic Geology showing a 3D model of the top of the Ellenberger surface. And in this view, all of the different injection intervals at depth and a 3D geological model with construction in progress. So where I think we need to head is into this sort of a space, which is a fictitious example, where an understanding of faults and stress architecture and disposal zone characteristics can be analyzed together in terms of deterministic or model outcomes with full analysis of uncertainties to assess fault reactivation potential from low to high at local to regional scales. And that's what we're working on in the TexNet Seismic Network and our Center for Integrated Seismicity Research, where approximately $6 million, mainly from the state of Texas, but also from industrial sponsors, is sponsoring us to develop the TexNet Network, which will monitor and catalog seismicity across Texas, and also the Center for Integrated Seismicity Research, where we will conduct fundamental and applied research on both natural and induced seismicity. And our goal with the TexNet and CSER project is to live within this space between academia and industry, government, and our regulators and the public and our educators. And the TexNet Seismic Network will expand the permanent stations across the state from the existing 18, adding another 23 to 25 permanent stations, as well as utilize 36 temporary stations, which will be moved around the state by experiment to analyze local occurrences of seismicity. Our research team spans six different units at the University of Texas, Texas A&M, and also SMU. And we have 13 active projects, and more research projects are being turned on all the time. And it spans our network and seismology, geologic and hydrologic description, reservoir geomechanics and petroleum engineering, seismic risk and hazard assessment, and also seismic risk social science. And our research plan calls for us to conduct statewide initiatives in black over the coming years and also to move around the state in terms of area of site-specific interpretation from the Fort Worth Basin, West Texas, South Texas, and elsewhere, with every one of those research areas resulting in an assessment of the basin scale seismogenic potential. All right, that's my last slide. Clearly, a physical understanding of the possible linkages between oil and gas operations and earthquakes is the first step we need to take to mitigate these unwanted effects. From data needs, we need better earthquake data in areas of natural and induced seismicity, and the TextNet network will provide that. We need better controls on faults in the subsurface. We really can't rely on seismicity to image those faults going forward. And then finally, we need better controls on disposal zone pore pressure distributions and pore pressure history, and especially from downhole data sources. And I think our regulators can help us get that type of data. From collaboration needs, we need fluid flow simulations from pore pressure estimations that are far more comprehensive and include realistic geological controls and realistic boundary conditions. Our subsurface integrated and mechanistic models, once they're constructed, they need to be revisited by interdisciplinary groups to learn more about the uncertainties of those models and improve their computational and predictive abilities. We need better models for fault triggering mechanisms. Faults aren't these simple planes. We have to use more complete descriptions of physics to understand them. And then finally, and I think for the state of Texas, it's vital that we develop resource assessments for disposal zone capacity throughout the state. Thank you.
Is the mic on? Are we coming up? Okay, good. Just to let you know, Mary Beth did give me information on Dr. Hennings that I failed to mention. And